It's Friday, and before we head into the weekend, it is time to get caught up on all the news that made headlines this week in our region. Joining me live in studio today for our Friday Reporter Roundtable are Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Don Day with Boise Dev, and Seth Ogilvy with Idaho Public Television. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
All right, let's just get right to the point. Paulette Jordan's campaign, everything that happened this week. Melissa or Seth, maybe start us off with how we got to where we are today.
So last Friday, there were some high-profile resignations from the Paulette Jordan campaign. Campaign staff turnover is not uncommon, mm-hmm. but for so many high-profile people to leave all at once, it was a little bit notable.
And it was also the second time that something like this happened, too.
Right. It happened during the primary.
And, I mean, not to bring my own family into it, but my mom, I think, frantically started calling me. I think she started trying to get a hold of you, too. Like, I mean, this is just something that...
Because she's a Paulette Jordan campaign volunteer, not because she's just an interesting...
Not just because she's just your mom.
Yeah,
just a mom.
Mom is just very concerned.
Yeah. Right. Using a story, son.
Your mom... Your mom knows you're in the media, so she's calling you, making sure you got the heads up.
Need a little bit of context here. But so fast forward to, I believe it was Wednesday when this story broke, that Paulette Jordan's and her campaign had been coordinating or working with this super PAC for a few months now. Super PACs, of course, are federal fundraising mechanisms that don't have the same kind of restraints when it comes to contributions that a lot of other campaigns and political action committees are bound by. Now, the Statesman article linked the staff resignations to the super PAC contributions, as well as what sounded like some personality conflicts within the campaign. Mm-hmm. That was in the letter that was leaked to the Statesman that reporter Cynthia Sewell verified with sources. There were no allegations of anything illegal. When it comes to super PACs, we're talking about this legal gray area, and they're federal political action committees, but Paulette Jordan, of course, is a state candidate, and any contributions or any fundraising done by her is governed by state election law. So we're in this fuzzy area, and the super PAC hasn't even spent any money as far as we know yet. So we're not going to know if anything eyebrow-raising happened until campaign finance reports come out. That said, there is an interesting question of judgment when you're in a very competitive general election gubernatorial race to spend energy and effort raising money for a super PAC that is, I think, going toward electing women nationwide as opposed to fundraising for your own campaign. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you really, really need coming up to the general election when you're running a statewide high-profile race like Paulette Jordan is.
And conceivably, there is a law being broken if there's actual coordination, because that is against the law if the campaign and the PAC are coordinating. That being said, it's almost impossible to prove that. So it you never really see charges pressed on that.
And like only coordination if it involves her own contributions to her mm-hmm. own campaign. I mean, we're talking about very, very fuzzy law here and there's no proof of that.
Well, and then let's talk about the fact that she had her staff sign non-disclosure agreements. So then this is leaked, and then Paulette Jordan is at a City Club of Idaho Falls meeting yesterday. And one of the questions at that meeting asked about a non-disclosure agreement. And I'm reading this from Nate Brown. He's a reporter, I believe, over in Idaho Falls.
Yes.
And he tweeted out saying that this was Jordan's response. So I'm quoting this. Gosh, you all really lean on Cynthia Sewell. You know, the media really leans on the lack of integrity with the Statesman. It's unfortunate.
Listen, you know, full disclosure here, my husband is an Idaho Statesman editor, but I will say that Cynthia Sewell is a very, very careful reporter.
Mm-hmm.
From everything I have heard, she was so careful. She didn't spring this on the Jordan campaign. If you read the article, she interviewed them. The Jordan campaign had every opportunity to respond. And they did give her a response. And so the Jordan campaign never said anything, as far as I can tell, was inaccurate with the story. So to attack reporters and an entire news organization's lack of integrity, I think it got a lot of people's attention. I saw a lot of chatter about it on social media.
And Cynthia is very respected, both in, I think, the community and in the reporting world. I mean, she was Reporter of the Year just recently. She's almost never questioned on her reporting. I don't this is very much out of the blue. But to get back to the NDAs, that is very uncommon. Like, after I heard that, I've been reaching out to other campaigns, even earlier Paulette Jordan campaigns, and saying, does anyone sign NDAs? And no one has said that they'd had to assign an NDA.
So but
I think it comes to, she has a lot of staff there now that comes from out of the state of Idaho. And signing NDAs isn't necessarily that uncommon outside of the state. But in Idaho, it is.
But here in Idaho, it is.
Right. National campaigns, you see it. You saw that, too, with not just Trump's campaign, but also his White House staffers. And so when we talk about it being uncommon, it's uncommon for Idaho. And, you know, we're just simple country Idaho reporters.
Exactly.
and that's the thing. I think this is notable, but I don't know that it's something to get worked up over.
But how do you think this could potentially affect her campaign moving forward? Because we are close to Election Day.
And I think you've got kind of a push of a lot of candidates riding what, you know, this called blue wave, based on not taking corporate funds, based on transparency, based on a lot of these kind of grassroots, not normal Washington swamp kind of campaigns. And I think people will look at taking money from a super PAC. People will look at the lack of transparency in an NDA and say, is this necessarily the person that I want? I mean, like, it seems like the folks doing the other thing are having a lot of success in the Democratic Party right now. So conceivably, it could hurt her.
You know, that said, I don't know that a lot of Paulette Jordan supporters really care. I think some of these things have raised some eyebrows, but ultimately, at the end of the day, will it change their vote? I really don't think a lot of this will when it comes to things like staff turnover or non-disclosure agreements. But if there are more things like this, if there are more attacks on the media and respected reporters, I mean, print reporter of the year, Cynthia Sewell, I think that might start to get people's attention. The bigger thing that I'm keeping an eye on, and you know, so much of this doesn't matter in a vacuum, but one of the most important things that a governor does is make calls on who to appoint to heads of agencies and commissions and divisions. So who a candidate surrounds himself or herself with is actually important, as is how they treat people. So this in a vacuum could very well be a personality conflict. That happens. Mm-hmm. People don't get along with their campaign managers. And that, you know, as we saw with Betsy Russell's reporting, seemed to be at least a good chunk of this, that there with campaign manager Michael Rosenau and Paulette Jordan, there's going to be some friction with every single campaign and the people that they bring on. But if there's a pattern of this, it makes you wonder how that person will act in an executive office. And Paulette Jordan certainly is not the only person who has had trouble keeping staffers on. You know, Raul Labrador went through several staffers in his first couple rounds as a first district congressman. You know, this is...
It's not an unfamiliar territory.
Yeah, and personality conflicts seem gossipy, but ultimately it does show how a person manages their offices, and that ultimately would affect Idaho citizens if they're appointing people and how they're working with people who are the heads of these agencies.
And these staffers, we'd have to assume, are the most passionate supporters of the candidate. And if you have two instances where the most passionate supporters of the candidate are saying, I don't want to be involved with this anymore, whether it is for personality conflicts or maybe the direction of the campaign, whatever it might be, I think that does, if the most passionate people aren't supporting anymore, you got to wonder if that does trickle down to just some of the normal folks that are supporting Paulette Jordan.
And ultimately, at the end of the day, it's not as important as things like policy.
Absolutely.
But it's notable. And I think that's what this moment is. It's notable. And then let's move on and start talking about policy.
And it made headlines. I want to shift gears a bit and bring Dawn into the conversation, because completely shifting gears, we're talking about housing developments. But Dawn, big deal in what happened this week in the city of Meridian. Can you get us updated on this?
Yeah, so it's probably good to clarify. It actually didn't happen this week. It just came to light this week on BoiseDev.com. And here's what happened. Looking at some of the developments in Meridian, there was a large proposal for a 38-acre parcel of land between I-84 and Meridian Road. So if you kind of visualize Meridian Road there, it's on the west side, huge piece of land. A developer wanted to build 127 houses and 272 apartments. And when you look at it, it actually is not the most controversial development in the world, but it was denied by City Council in Meridian after passing planning and zoning. And what happened is City Council had to approve an amendment to their comprehensive plan. What's interesting is they are currently redoing the comprehensive plan for the whole city. Where it gets a little tricky is within that same meeting, they actually gave out a comp plan amendment approval to another developer of another project. And then on this project, so, well, we want to hold off because we're redoing the comp plan. Luke Kavanagh, who is a city councilman out there, was kind of like, my head is spinning. I don't understand why we're doing this for one and not for another. This is kind of confusing. So the city then went back and had a meeting about 2 weeks later to set forth policy. And what they decided was the planning staff was going to tell all developers that if they have a comp plan amendment, that they strongly discourage them from submitting that until the comprehensive plan is done, which could take up to a year. It's not a moratorium because by Idaho state law that meets a higher standard. They don't want to do that, but it is a sort of strong discouragement. It raises a lot of questions. Obviously, we need more housing right now, so this individual project and the fate of that is a little confusing. But then what happens for other things in Meridian if people want to change that comprehensive plan to allow something that might not currently be defined in the letter of the law?
What's interesting about that, too, is Meridian just keeps growing.
It does, yeah.
So, and we had the mayor, we had Mayor Tammy in here talking about the comprehensive plan about a month or two ago.
Yeah.
It is needed. They update it about every 10 years, and Meridian has grown exponentially in 10 years. But what does that do, as you said, Don, then? Do they just stop?
Yeah, so I talked to the developer, Matt Schultz, on this, and he was a little surprised, I think, and he actually hopes to get another shot at it. The parcel of land has a development agreement that would have made it basically commercial, big box type commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Their point was this probably isn't the right spot for big box commercial. It's set off of Meridian Row. The access is a little tough. And they did a traffic study that actually showed that this plan would have 70% less traffic than sort of a, you know, big box commercial with Staples and that kind of stuff in it.
And we need more traffic. Yeah,
right.
Area.
And so his point was, well, you know what? ACHD approved this. We were going to do some roads and put some infrastructure in here. But the city just kind of wants to wait. Where I thought it got interesting, at least for the purposes of my story, is that they did approve another development in that same meeting for an industrial park that was next to some homes. So you kind of had to like thread the needle a little bit on the logic to sort of understand. And you can kind of see what their case is. I laid that out in the story up on BoiseDev.com where you can kind of see what they're trying to say there. And what happens going forward will be interesting. But it's not a damper on growth, and it's only for comp plan amendments, so a lot of things will still get through. But it definitely does put a little bit of a pause on a few things as this whole area is growing really fast and the economy is hot and developers are trying to figure out what they do with their land and how we solve some problems like housing and affordable housing and all of those things. It's a very complicated situation, not just in Meridian, but in Boise and Nampa and Caldwell and Emmett. And it's
everywhere. Well, yeah. And maybe it's a good thing that there's a bit of a pause, though, to relook at things, especially while they're in the midst of a comprehensive plan.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people will say that. Planning staff told the mayor actually asked if there were anything else there was anything else of this type in the pipeline, and they said no. Matt Schultz's sort of frustration was that they actually started the process of this development before the comp plan started to be reevaluated. So I think that's where there's some frustration. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens next, not just with this, but the whole city of Meridian as they grapple with just exploding growth.
We're continuing our conversation with our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My panel today includes Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Don Day with Boise Dev, and Seth Ogilvie with Idaho Public Television. Melissa, want to talk about the Idaho Freedom Foundation and their analysis about the Medicaid expansion.
Right. This is specifically a counter to a Milliman firm report that analyzed Idaho's cost and savings over the next 10 years if Idaho were to expand Medicaid. So in Milliman's own report, they acknowledge that it is just an estimate and there is a whole range of numbers in there. A high of nearly $635 million over 10 years. And so that is compared to what the federal government would be spending, which is almost $5 billion for Idaho's healthcare. So we're talking, you know, about 10% of what the federal government would be spending. This week, the Idaho Freedom Foundation, which has opposed Medicaid expansion and has a PAC called Work Not Obamacare, which will be spending money on efforts to get voters to vote against Proposition 2 Medicaid expansion. They came out with a rebuttal to mm-hmm. the Milliman report that pointed out that there were some potential problems in Milliman's estimates in other states, that other states that had expanded Medicaid had doubled, in some cases more than doubled, the enrollees that they had initially estimated. So Montana, when they did a what was called the HELP Act, their version of Medicaid expansion, they had 104%, or I mean more than double of what they were what they initially thought
that they would get.
And so that on its face will tell you that, okay, Idaho is going to spend more. But our associate producer, Devin Downey, started looking through the footnotes of the Idaho Freedom Foundation's policy paper and going to the actual original sources of what the Freedom Foundation cited. In the same paper that the Freedom Foundation said, look, this is proof that we're going to be spending a lot more money because Montana did. They actually found that Montana ended up saving a lot of money. They saw a 49% reduction in uncompensated care for hospitals.
Oh, interesting.
They saw additional tax revenues.
So even though
more than $40 million, they saw their own state tax savings of about $58 million. And so it was interesting that the sources that the Freedom Foundation cited, a lot of them use their own fuzzy math, which is what they accused Milliman of doing, or they actually painted a pretty decent picture, or at least a neutral picture, of Medicaid expansion. We've reached out. We're working with Audrey Dutton from the Idaho Statesman. Mm-hmm. We've reached out to the Idaho Freedom Foundation for a response, as well as a response from the Department of Health and Welfare, to ask about the Milliman report and how they got those numbers and how many drafts, whether they worked with Milliman to kind of lower those numbers, quite frankly. We're waiting to hear back, but look for that story on our blog and in the Idaho Statesman in the next few days.
And it should be really good because we've just been talking about it in the office, and it's been wild what you've come up with, what Devin's come up with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure what Audrey's going to come up with. But the thing that's always kind of mind-boggling to me is we've had 30, maybe 31 states roll this out already. You'd think we'd have a good idea of what it's going to cost. And yet, for some reason, we don't. And I can't ever tell if that's people always want to like put their factors on it or if it's just the uniqueness of every state. And like, I don't think Idaho is necessarily that much different than Montana,
but everyone
says it is.
But every single state has its own different set of circumstances. We all have our own Medicaid setups. We all have our own population of what we call the working poor, you know, people who are working full time, but don't make enough to qualify for subsidies for the state insurance exchange and don't qualify for Medicaid under our current system. And so not only that, you don't know how, even if it's there, people might not enroll,
mm-hmm.
you know, even if it's there, people might not take advantage of it. So we, honest to goodness, don't know. And the Idaho Freedom Foundation is absolutely right about that. The Milliman report is just an estimate. It is not gospel truth. And Milliman themselves.
They've said it's basically an estimate.
Right. But I think a lot of people look at the numbers and say, okay, this is what we've got, as opposed to, you know, looking at what Milliman says and say, and there are so many factors that we don't know about, you know, whether the federal funding structure is going to change. There are so many unknown. So the Freedom Foundation has a very good point there. But they're also relying on sources that use their own mm-hmm. fuzzy math.
So your full report, you guys will have it on your blog and also with the Statesman as well coming up.
Yeah.
And then Seth, you've been working on a story regarding the death penalty here in Idaho?
Yeah, it's a story that kind of has everything that I think a journalist is interested in. It's got public records, it's got executions, it's got kind of ideas of secrecy. So a professor from the University of Idaho basically filed a public records request almost a year ago.
We had her on the program and talked with her. Right.
So if you go through all of the documents, the way in which it's worked is fascinating. So she gets three documents initially mm-hmm. from the...
And what she wants, to clarify, she wants to know what drugs are being used in executions, correct? Because right now you don't necessarily have to...
She wants to know how they're stored, how they're right. prepared, because we have an idea of what drugs they are. We just don't know how they're administered, how they're prepared, how they're stored. And if the state of Idaho says that they have not bought any new drugs for future executions. So if they have drugs on hand to execute the next group of folks, they've been sitting around for a while.
So are they effective? Are they not?
Exactly. Right. And we know that back in 2010, 2011, there was kind of this nationwide crisis mm-hmm. when the drugs stopped being manufactured and other states had to go to, I guess you'd call them dodgy sources, right. or at least...
Hence why she ended up filing this public records.
Exactly. And I got to say this right off the bat. The Department of Corrections has actually been really good to me on public records requests before, waiving fees, helping me out. So I'm not casting a large pox on their house or anything like that. But,
well, good to get that on the record. Yeah.
Well, and I will say this. We've had Henry Utencio on mm-hmm. the program here, the director of the IDOC. And I think he in my opinion, I think, was very transparent about the department.
Yeah. And the department really believes that basically they can't follow through on their responsibility to execute people if they hand over this data or these documents. Hmm. And the timeline is really interesting. Three documents at first, then she files a lawsuit, and all of a sudden 900. 1,600 documents come, which gives you an idea of when you file a public records request, maybe if you mm-hmm. file a lawsuit.
It's amazing what happens
things
when
might,
you file
things
that.
Might change. But to get to the end, the big nutcraft of the story that's going to come out very soon is in the process that going to trial this week, the judge had actually said, why did you not hold the Department of Corrections in contempt of court? Because they should have handed over these documents, but you never asked me to hold them in contempt. So that's why we're going to a trial, which I thought is an interesting portion that was left out of a lot of the reporting.
Interesting. All right. We're going to switch gears again as we wrap this up, because let's talk about something a little bit lighter, a little bit more fun. Don, there's a new concept coming to the Boise bench.
This is fascinating. It's called, I should get it right, Beans and Brews on Vista Avenue on the bench. And what's interesting, I'm sorry, it's not Beans and Brews. It's Beans and Bikes. Yeah,
beans
I was going to get that wrong.
Lime
well,
beans.
Maybe there'll be some limes in there, too. Yes. Maybe it should be Beans, Brews, and Bikes.
I got it wrong. It's Bikes and Beans. I'll get this right out there. Okay. Sorry,
jelly beans?
So here's,
isn't Beans and Brews just camping?
So here's what's happening. A local guy named Andrew Little has been doing some research for actually a couple of years, and he has found that people who are repairing their bikes also like coffee. I guess that makes sense. And people right. who like coffee yeah. like to ride their bikes. I don't like to ride my bike, but I do.
I would spill the coffee all over yeah, myself right? when I was riding
so
my
what
bike.
He's done is he started a little joint over there that will help you fix your bike and serve you with some coffee. So I said flat tires and flat whites.
I like
so
it.
So you can get that. And it's right over by the Alpenhouse Deli, not too far from Vista
Village. Okay, so it's
like
right there by
Vista.
Yeah,
Red Bench Pizza's right there. Mm-hmm. So
can they help you put a cup holder on?
But yeah, right. That's it.
They should.
They should have like branded cup holders, and they'll probably get the name of their business right. So Bikes and Beans on Vista.
That is so Boise,
isn't it?
So
right? That's what I thought.
I love that.
Well, just opened this week.
Just this week. Well, I appreciate all three of you coming in. Always fun with our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My panel today: Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Don Day with Boise Dev, and Seth Ogilvie with Idaho Public Television. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.